Call to order the meeting of the House Committee on Rules. It's Wednesday, April 20th, 2011. Welcome, everybody. We've got a series of bills. I think we'll generally go in order, although we always end up going a little bit out of order as things proceed. So we'll roll with those punches. But begin by, we don't have any measures to introduce, do we?
That's correct.
Okay. So we'll begin by opening up a public hearing on HCR 23.
HCR 23 memorializes former Representative Senator and State Treasurer Ben Westland. You have the Dash 1 amendment from Representative Berger that identifies the friend who convinced Ben Westland to run for public office, that person being Lynn Lundquist.
Let's go, in addition to Representative Gelser, let's go ahead and have former Representative Lundquist and Mike Salvaggio. Is Mike here as well?
Yes.
There he is in the back. Yeah, go ahead, Lynn. All three of you come up with Sarah at the same time. Welcome to the Rules Committee.
Thank you very much, Chair Hunt, Chair Olson, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Sarah Gelser from House District 16 in Corvallis and Philomath in Benton County. HCR 23 does not require much introduction at all. We all have known and loved Ben Westland, some of us for varying periods of time. I was thinking today about telling the story of the first day that I met Ben, and then I realized this would not be an appropriate place to tell that story. But I'll tell you all some other time. I think all of us knew Ben as a friend, as a statesman, as a person that loved this state, loved his community, really reached out to serve and support and mentor all of those who came behind him, to serve behind him. I clearly remember a day that he came to my office and just wanted to know how I was doing because he thought that I was not walking with a spring in my step down the hall. And he wanted to make sure that I was remembering to call my family and spend time with my children and keep focused on what is most important in life. My children would tell you that Ben taught me two of the most important things that you should know about the House. And that is how to slide down the banisters in front of the House chamber and where the ice cream is kept. So my children certainly have a fondness for Ben as well. I think my staff, Chris Scarrow, could tell you about her birthday in 2009 when Ben took the time to come and hand deliver a box of cereal to her. And, of course, he had a way of making that presentation very funny. Ben is someone we could all count on, that we can all admire, who is very much missed. And I think his wise words about where we need to go as a state, how to focus on what's important, and the importance of restructuring our revenue system are words that we would do well to heed today. And I think he is certainly deserving of our remembrance on the House floor. So I hope you will move this out quickly and join me in celebrating his life and all of the many gifts that he gave to so many of us and the people of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for inviting me to come before you today. And I am very, very proud of the fact that I did introduce Ben to politics. I will tell you it wasn't the hardest sell in the world. even though he had been observing what had happened to my early political situation. And so he had some questions. But I remember specifically when he decided to run and then he was elected and so forth, that he wanted to be on the Ways and Means Committee. And I wasn't, even though he's, you know, has a great business background and so forth, I just really wondered, because I knew Ben very, very well, and I knew there were other things that made him tick in life besides just the numbers game. But he was bound determined, and he took to it very well. And in fact, I think that the session that he wasn't, again, put in as co-chairs of Ways and Means was a really big big hurdle for him to cross mentally. I want to talk just a little bit about some things that perhaps some of you don't know about Ben. Obviously, the Representative Gelser has done a good job of leading off, and we all know what human person he was and how he can relate to everybody and so forth. But I knew Ben when he first came to this, basically to Eastern Oregon, when he went to a little town of Mitchell and got into the cattle business. He actually was running away from a little bit of vices that had given him trouble, that he was very open about. That, I think, speaks volumes as well. He knew he had to do something, and that was his attempt to do that. Ben, when he got into the ranching business, was sort of a duck out of water. He didn't know anything about ranching. And unfortunately, with his finances, and he started purchasing animals and so forth, he got used by the cattle industry at the auctions. They would bid him up, and I don't know how many of you have been to auctions, but, you know, they'll just pull a bid out of the air so that you can keep raising the bid up for the person that really has the money behind it. And I took Ben aside one day, and I said, Ben, you know, you're getting used. And so I spoke to him, and before long, he knew how to overcome that. You know, that's what Ben would do. And in the ranching business, we always say that if we could have one good cow, one good dog, and one good horse in our lifetime, we're really lucky. I don't think Ben really knew much about that, but he had one good bull. And he was very proud of Reggie. And I was there when he purchased Reggie in Denver, when he was standing with his dirty coveralls. He was working for a rancher from Connell, Washington, just with the cattle and so forth. But he wasn't up on the stands where all the bidders were. He was just off on the edge of the ring there, and with his coveralls and his baseball cap, looking about as non-rancher as you could be. And when he paid $160,000 for this bull, everyone, you know, didn't know what to think. But there was one thing about Ben. He always knew where he was going. He didn't know a lot about the ranching industry, but he knew how to market. And that's what he did. And he was very, very successful in that. And one thing that he didn't do in the ranch, which I think speaks volumes of him as well, he never had to wear a 10-gallon hat. There are a lot of people that get into the ranching business because of resources that goes to their head. That was not Ben. He had his baseball cap on, and that's who he was. And he rubbed elbows with people with 10-gallon hat, and it didn't bother him a bit. He was genuine, and I think that was one of the areas that, to me, that spoke about that. I think one of his greatest challenges that he had was when he became a Democrat, and I don't say that in any negative way to the party or anything else, but it was a big change for Ben. He became an independent fairly easily. We didn't have any conversations about that, but I remember the Sunday morning when I was on my deck, and we spoke, I bet you, for 3 hours on the phone. He was really struggling. What should he do? And the reason he became a Democrat was this, and I think, again, it speaks highly of who he really was. He simply wanted to be in a position that he could have an influence on policy. And that was his bottom line. He really believed that that gave him the opportunity, because where he was with the party at that time just didn't allow that to happen. So he was willing, in my opinion, he was willing, in a sense, to sacrifice some of his core, and the sacrifice is probably the wrong terminology, but he was willing to give up on some of his core values as a Republican, because he really did. And many of you were here when he made the great speech on the floor after his difficulties with health issues. And that's, I sometimes think we need those, perhaps, to really bring out the best in us. I'll just close by giving you a side of Ben that I think a lot of don't know, and that was the quiet side of Ben. He was very outgoing. He could talk to anybody anytime about anything. It didn't make any difference. But there was a quiet side to him. And some of you may know that he spent time on the House floor, usually, you know, at midnight or something like that. I've been there with him. Well, he just went in, and he was, what you might say, almost awestruck by what was there in history and so forth. And that was a special time to him. And I'll finish by saying that one event that Ben and I didn't get to participate in that I hope will give you some idea of this quiet side of him. I have a place in Christmas Valley. It's my grandfather's homestead, and it's out in the middle of nowhere. We built a cabin and an outhouse and a barn, so we've duplicated that. And Ben wanted to come down there with me, and he never had that opportunity. But here's what would have happened. Remember now, this is out in the middle of nowhere, and Ben would have gotten up, perhaps in the middle of the night, to relieve himself, and he would have gone to the outhouse with a bright sky. And I'm sure he would have left the door open and probably sat there and just really took in. He would have taken in what is out there in Mother Nature. That was Ben. And as he would have traveled from the outhouse to the house, because they aren't too close together, he would have been probably listening to the coyotes singing, and that would have made a great impression upon him, Ben. He loved those kind of times. And I think he would have followed that by sitting on the porch before he came into the house and, again, contemplating what this world is all about and his role in it. That's the kind of friend Ben was. Ben was a friend to me, and he was really good for Oregon. I'm glad I knew him.
Thanks, Lynn. Mike.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Silvaggio from Salem. I simply wanted to take a moment of the committee's time to relate a very short story about my friend Ben. In working closely with Ben for some years, I know that it's easy to focus on big picture Ben, the gregarious, largest-life politician who seemed to weave respect and irreverence together to create a memorable, effective, and almost legendary swath of a political career, the wry smile and the occasional and impractical cowboy hat, though not 10 gallons, the guy who used bull genetics as currency, the guy who doled out folksy jokes and slaps on the back at his backyard barbecues. But Ben was also a gentle, exquisite soul. He might pause in the middle of campaign work to contemplate the way that the sunlight was dancing on Mirror Pond. He might take a moment to appreciate the arrangement of petals on a wildflower. Or he might just stay in his seat long after a Dodger game ended to be found by the cleaning crew simply pondering the field in the night sky. In 2005, Ben used his bizarre charm to somehow entice me to come to work on his rogue campaign. It was, by all accounts, a shoestring effort that was at first held together by masking tape and little swabs of Nicorette gum that Ben would leave everywhere. Somehow we made it work, but when I first got to Ben, the 05-06 winter was just starting up. And having grown up in California, I wondered what the heck Ben had gotten me into while I, then absent any ability to drive a car in the snow, trudged to the supermarket for my provisions. Though, through what then seemed to me like a blizzard of absolutely apocalyptic proportion, I came out of the store still soaking wet and uneasy about walking home across the vast tundra that was once Franklin Avenue. And on top of that, some local yahoo in a Yukon SUV was flashing his headlights and honking his horn at me. Of course, I know now that it could only have been Ben. From the road, he'd seen me as what he later described as a wet rat walk into the store and had dutifully waited in the parking lot simply so he could give me a lift home. And as I stayed in Bend over the next year, I found that it was not only Ben's staff who had such privileges, but in fact it seemed uncommon for a local Bendite to not have experienced some act of kindness at his hand, from providing a lift to a random person whose car had just broken down to helping people find jobs. Ben cared very much about the little things in life, just as he did for his big state policy items. And this was driven home for me one day at a photo shoot in downtown Bend. I had stopped the photographer because I had noticed little bulges in all of Ben's pockets. And amidst some grumbling and a profane joke or two, I finally convinced Ben to empty his pockets. A small stone, a rusty jackknife, an odd coin, and I thought, what is this junk in his pocket? I asked Ben, and it completely disarmed me when he held each artifact in turn as he related a very personal story about it. Whether it was a souvenir of a family vacation, a memento of a personal achievement, or a reminder of a lost family member. And these are the things that he carried with him, both figuratively and literally. Even though it was a side of himself that he shared freely with all of us, I feel very fortunate to have been privy to that intimate side of him. And though this brief statement is a poor substitute for knowing Ben, I thank the committee for allowing me to put on record for those that didn't. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for our witnesses? Seeing none, thank you all very much. Appreciate your coming and bringing this resolution forward. Anyone else like to testify on HCR 23? Seeing none, I would close the public hearing and open a work session on HCR 23. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the dash one amendment to HCR 23 and speak to the amendment.
Representative Berger moves the dash one amendment to HCR 23. Your amendment.
Mr. Chair, I ordered this amendment because friend seemed anonymous and the friend has revealed himself. I am glad that he has come forward on the record because I didn't have it confirmed until this minute and I was a little worried that Polyfax would come and fact check that it was actually Lynn Lundquist who got Ben Westland to run. But now we have it on the record and so the Polyfax is in his doorstep and off of mine, and I think it is appropriate that we name the person who actually got Ben into this business.
Any further discussion on the dash one amendment? Any objection? Motion is approved. Co-Chair Olson, do you want to move the...
Well, absolutely, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I move HCR 23 as amended to the House floor with the due adopt.
Co-Chair Olson moves HCR 23 as amended to the floor with the due adopt recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, Amy.
Representative Winger.
Aye.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Representative Freeman.
Yes.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Co-Chair Olson.
Aye.
Co-Chair Hunt.
Aye. Motion is approved, and Representative Gelser, would you be willing to carry the resolution? Very good. Thank you. Close the work session on HCR 23. We could move on to the next one.
As sure, is.
Okay. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3417. Mr. Sambridge.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3417 specifies the requirements of financial management systems for public charter schools. It requires districts extended weighted average daily membership, that's the ADMW, to be calculated separately for students in public charter schools and students in district schools. You have several amendments to this bill that were, they've been out for quite a while, but they were just delivered to me a little while ago. I don't have a summary of them, but it's the dash 1, dash 2, and dash 3 should be in your packet. They've also been posted to the S drive.
And I think it's fair to say the ones to focus on, and I think the folks who are going to be testifying are going to be focusing on the dash threes. So you can keep the dash one and dash two in your file, but most of the discussion will probably be on the dash threes. I invite forward Wes Rogers and Karen Heikes. Welcome to the House Rules Committee. Wes, you want to be in?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Wes Rogers. I'm the business manager for Oregon City School District in Oregon City, Oregon. We have four charter schools in our district representing approximately 750 ADM. I'm here to testify in support of the House Bill 3417 and its amendments. The district feels that this would be a step forward, especially in the area of sound financial management. And
Wes, could I just interrupt? Are you speaking to the dash threes specifically? Because we do have three amendments in front of us. Dash three amendments.
I don't have those in front of me at this time, but I can.
Looking at your sheet, it looks like it responds to the dash three amendments.
Yeah,
so
yeah, they do. They reference those in the sections and so forth. But
okay.
Specifically, the dash three amendments on the amendment addressing the ADMW calculation. The district has encountered in the past some technicalities related to the SSF formula and how charter school ADMW is included with non-charter school ADMW. And it prevented us from allowing one of our charter schools growing because at the same time the charter school wanted to grow, the district was in hold harmless and was losing enrollment. And it set up a situation where the district would not receive any additional SSF revenue for the charter school growth, but we'd end up having to pay the charter school more funds because of the fact that we had to pass through more money based upon their ADM. By separating the ADM calculation, then the charter schools can go up and down independently of what the district ADM is doing at the same time. And so issues around poverty or hold harmless and whether ADM is growing or falling are really split apart into the two entities. And then the entities are added together, and the money is then flowed through the local district, which we're more than happy to do and support that relationship. We're very supportive of our charter schools. We see them as partners in our community, and that we feel both, I think that's why Karen is here specifically as well, to support that breaking apart of the ADM calculation. There's also a short in the original bill, I mentioned in my first section of my comments that we're interested in having our charter schools speak the same financial language that we speak. And so I think that would be a good step for them so that we're both using the same types of accounting structures, and then we can include their data in our audit report much more easily. And then we can also help them report their information to ODE in a format that's compatible with ours and the rest of those public schools throughout the state. And that's my comments.
Thanks. Karen, welcome to the Rules Committee.
Thank you so much, Chair Hunt. This is my first time testifying before the Rules Committee in any legislative session. I've been doing this since 2005, so my name is Karen Hykus, and I am the director of the Northwest Center for Educational Options, which is basically the state's charter school association. I think I do know most of you through other committees and other work. We do support this House bill. We actually supported the original version as well. There were three elements in that version. We supported all of those, but the remaining two we still support. We do believe that the charters in the district should speak the same language. By the way, I know Wes very well. I've worked with his district off and on for many years, helped them start charter schools, worked with their charter schools, and can definitely vouch for the collaborative relationship that this district has initiated and sustained with its charter schools. Our organization does everything we can to collaborate, which is why I wanted to testify on this bill today. I didn't anticipate a lot of opposition, but we like to demonstrate support and consensus and collaboration wherever we can, because that's not always the case with charter school issues. So we do believe that the districts and charters should speak the same language. We always have advised charter schools to use the same cost code structuring that the state uses and that districts use, because it's simpler for everyone to understand what the budgets mean. We also support the separation of the charter and district ADM for the very reason Wes shared with you, so that districts can retain their hold harmless status if they are declining enrollment districts, but the charters can still increase their enrollment if there's demand in the community for those spots. Also, this particular piece, the separation of the ADM, helps solve an implementation issue that remains with the bill that has passed out of the House, House Bill 2299, which is now in Senate Education, and will change the special education piece of the charter school law so that students on IEPs become residents of the sponsoring district. And if we don't put this piece in, then some districts and charters will kind of suffer financially in the transition. So that's another reason we support this bill.
Thank you.
We appreciate the opportunity to testify and welcome any questions.
Great. Thanks. Questions for our witnesses? Representative Barnhart, if you could pull the mic your direction, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make certain that I'm tracking this correctly. You indicated the situation that might arise when the district is in the hold harmless position while the charter school is growing. And I think I understand that if, under the current rule, the district would get no additional funds, but would have to pay the charter school more because it had gotten bigger. Under the rule that you've proposed, if I understand it correctly, the district would continue to be in a hold harmless situation, but because the charter school was growing, the district would get additional funds to account for those additional students in the charter school, which then would be added together for the purpose of the state school fund grant. I got that part. Are there other circumstances under which the distribution to the district from the state school fund would be different than it is now? Is that the only one, or are there other situations too?
Chair Hunt, Representative Barnhart, members of the committee, I can't think of anyone right offhand. When we went through the SSF calculation related to ADMW, we could not see any other circumstances or issues related to that, except for that hold harmless environment that we as a district found ourselves in. So at this point, I'd have to say I don't know of any.
Great.
Representative Barnhart?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The hold harmless, if I'm recalling correctly, is one of those situations that applies from year to year, doesn't it? If you dropped enrollment in 1 year, you would be held harmless the next year, but then not after that. Have I got that right? Assuming the population in the district stayed the same thereafter.
Chair Hunt, Representative Barnhart, members of the committee. The hold harmless is like a two-year moving forward window.
Okay.
You get the highest of either the current year or the previous year, whichever is greater.
Right. So if I could follow up. So if you are at X number the first year and at X minus something the next year, you in the second year you would get X, the equivalent of X. In the third year, assuming you continued to be at X minus the same something, you would only get the amount for X minus the same something in the third year. Have I got that right?
Chair Hunt, Representative Barnard, members of the committee, that's correct. The next year is a different calculation,
right?
And then you would either use the current year or you use the previous year, and then the second previous year would then fall off of the calculation. And so it gives you a year to plan and decide and to adjust your programs for lack of the enrollment decline. So that's correct. You're tracking.
And then I think this is my last question. Depending upon the answer, this is basically a change in the school fund distribution formula, isn't it?
Chair Hunt, Representative Barnard, members of the committee, I think that would probably be a fair assessment that we are going to be changing the ADM calculation by breaking those two apart. That would be a change in the formula then.
Right. Thank you. That answers my question. Leads me to a different issue, but not for these witnesses.
Okay. Other questions for these witnesses? Seeing none. Karen West, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Appreciate being here. Anyone else like to testify on House Bill 3417? This, as I think Karen referenced, there is, I think it's fair to say that there is consensus among not just the two witnesses, but a wide range, maybe the complete wide range of education groups that are involved in this. And so you may be hearing from other groups that are in support of this, but I think all the education groups are in support of this bill with the dash threes. So I would close.
Mr. Chair, before we go on,
please.
And I'll mention it now because I think it's something the committee may want to consider for later. This is the kind of issue which normally falls within the purview of the Revenue Committee because it's a change in the school formula. That was the purpose of my last question.
Right. And fortunately, the co-chairs of the House Revenue Committee also serve on this committee, so you get the double benefit of that by being here. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3417. And should we wait for Representative Parrish, or?
You could just wait for just a couple minutes.
Okay. She was right outside. Amy, you might want to just poke your head outside and see if Representative Parrish is just right out in the hall. Let's go ahead and jump over House Bill 3628. We'll come back to it and open a work session on House Bill 3576. Mr. Sembridge.
Mr. Chairman, this is House Bill 3576. You heard this on March 21st. It has to do with determining the required habitation within a district required for serving as a state representative or senator. You have the dash one amendment, which replaces the measure. It allows elections officials to consider several factors in determining whether or not a candidate inhabits a district, including but not limited to where a personal mail is received, the addresses of a driver's license, motor vehicle registration, utility tax returns, as well as voter registration, if any. We have the fiscal and revenue analysis of the dash one, no revenue impact, no fiscal impact.
Representative Holvey, do you want to speak to, I think we had talked about this amendment previously, although I'm losing track a little bit about what we've talked about in the committee or what we may all have talked about one-on-one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I got to identify myself for the record. Paul Holvey, State Representative, District 8. The dash one amendment basically just provides some better criteria for the Secretary of State to look at some factors when considering whether or not somebody is qualified to run for the office of state senator or state representative. We ran into some issues around this in the last election cycle, and there are some differences between, definition of what a registered voter is and what a candidate is, because the candidacy refers to the Constitution, so we're not able to actually specify exactly what that means. But at least we now have in statute some specific criteria for the Secretary of State's office to make a decision with.
Ask him a couple questions.
You bet. And
thank you for that suggestion.
Yeah, well, Steve Trout come forward, and also just a reminder that we did the dash ones we actually did adopt. So the bill we're looking at is the amended version. We put in the dash ones on April 20th. Steve, welcome back to the Rules Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Steve Trout, State Election Director.
Mr. Chair, a couple years ago, we had a little bit of a problem with a candidate, and then eventually a ruling was made from your office that apparently their residence where they lived at was not within the House District. I guess my – does this – just clarify the direction for you, where you're needing to go, or what you had a couple years ago, was that sufficient enough to make a decision on what was happening? That's what.
So, Mr. Chairman, this gives us a list of things that we can include. Previously, currently, there is no list. We just had to use what we thought was the right thing in trying to determine residency. So I think this not only gives us something to hang our hat on, but also makes it clearer for anyone that would be looking at the statutes and considering whether they reside versus inhabit a district, which is really the issue here, would make that clearer for them.
Mr. Kocher, please.
How often do you see something like this happen? I know you've only been up here with us for, you know, just a short time, but do you have any idea at all, Steve, how often something like this would apply?
Right. And Mr. Chair, in my experience of doing elections for almost 15 years, they kind of come in waves, and they're always very specific fact patterns and scenarios. And so, as I've worked with Representative Holvey on this, we've been trying to tighten things up, recognizing that we're not going to be able to cover all of the situations and the circumstances, but at least to give us a little bit more guidance and direction, so that it will limit the number that will be potentially going to court and require litigation to determine whether someone can in fact run and whether they in fact reside or inhabit the district.
Now I just have one follow-up Charles. Question. You have for Section 1 going down into 1C, where the candidate registers motor vehicles for personal use. What happens if you have an individual that has a vehicle that they've just left abandoned and they're in a, you know, that has a address other than what they're residing at?
Right. Mr. Chair, these are guiding principles. Just because it's not a make or break list, it's just things that we can consider. We have to consider the totality of the circumstances taking all of the information that we have to make the best decision that we can based on the information we have. This just gives us things that we can look at and that we can justify when we're making those decisions to say, you know, statute says that we can look at these things. The candidate has their driver's license at this address, which is within the district, so that, you know, doesn't make a total determination that they are entitled to reside or entitled to run there, but it gives them kind of shifts that burden of, okay, well, that's one point in their favor, so it they'd have to provide some much more contrary information to get off of that point.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hunt. To some degree, I think we're looking for a solution to a problem that we're not easily defining. So I think there is some issue that we're trying to solve from a recent election that we are continuing to throw words at. A couple things I want to ask about specifically with this, where it starts talking about the elections official may consider, but it's not limited to considering. So in one circumstance, they could consider some of this, and in other circumstances, they really don't have to. So to me, that level of ability to pick and choose what we're going to use as criteria is a little bit troubling. Right off where the candidates receive personal mail. I'll tell you, it so happens my business is where I live, in the same district currently, but I get my personal mail at work. You know, and so when I start reading through these, I see all kinds of situations. Somebody could raise a question or a concern over one of these things you've listed, and then it's up to the Secretary of State or the elections official to establish whether they're in the right thing, and it seems awful arbitrary to me. I think we're trying to fix a problem that doesn't exist.
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Freeman, I think currently there's no guidance there. I think the intent here is to at least identify some criteria that may be considered, whereas currently there are no criteria listed at all, and so it's totally up to the election official.
Representative Freeman. I'm sorry, I want to make sure I understood that right. There's no criteria to live in your district to run for office?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Freeman, there is the definition that you have to reside, but as far as what residency means,
and
we discussed this at our first hearing, okay. Inhabitancy versus residency, if I'm going to a university, I can be registered to vote. Not necessarily on campus, I can, but I could also remain registered where I originally resided if I have an intent to return there. And so that's residency, as it applies to elections, is really gets really complicated and can get convoluted very quickly. And so we're just trying to provide some guidance here. I think the point you're making is there's not a lot of teeth here, and I think I acknowledge that. I think Representative Holvey does, but at the same time, it's better than nothing.
Can I follow up, please?
Representative Freeman.
I'm not saying there's not a lot of teeth here. There's a lot of ability to pick and choose what you want to use as criteria. That's what's troubling to me. If there was a shall consider in a list of things that had to be met, I'd feel very comfortable. It's the idea that you can pick and choose from a list of things and in some situations use them and some not around the state of Oregon, depending on the candidate or a variety of other factors. That's what's troubling to me.
Representative Holvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like a chance to comment on Representative Freeman's questions, and they're good ones, ones that I originally asked as well. The issue is in fact, that inhabitancy is part of the Constitution, and that requirement is in the Constitution. And our statutes cannot limit the Constitution, and therefore we couldn't say shall in all of these cases. The current situation is that we could have a candidate, and in a specific instance, who had all of these elements, had a driver's license in a different district, was registered to vote in a different district, had received their mail in a different district, but based on an affidavit that they lived in the other district, was able to qualify to be a candidate. That is the issue that the Secretary of State finds themselves in, is that there was some evidence produced, the affidavit, that the candidate lived in a specific district, and based on that Constitution requirement and not having any sort of statutory direction on what types of things they should look at for inhabitancy, they felt compelled to qualify that candidate to run for office. And so this is just basically laid out there that gives them some statutory direction on things that they could consider for establishing somebody as a qualified candidate. They can't necessarily, we couldn't list these in saying that a candidate shall be all these things, because then it would be limiting the Constitution. So that's the scenario that we're in, and this bill's just meant to give a little more clarity, a little more statutory background and criteria for the Secretary of State to make these decisions, because right now I'm not sure how they make their decisions. I think they make their decisions just based on somebody that says, I live here and I want to run, and that's it. There's no other criteria.
Sure.
Representative Wingard, then we'll go to Representative Wingard first. I'm sorry. He was in the queue. If you could pull your mic over, too. Oh, I guess it's there. I'm sorry. I'm looking at the wrong mic.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am sympathetic to the problem that Representative Holvey has outlined about the constitutional problem with how you word the bill. But I must share my concern that without clear direction, this gives any Secretary of State kind of, in my mind, a troubling amount of latitude about making a decision about whether somebody qualifies to run in a district. And you have so many things on the list that a person could have some of these and not, and what becomes the tipping point, who decides. And that's a tremendous amount of authority to give the Secretary of State, which is a partisan office, and I'm not suggesting anything about the current occupant. I mean, it's just a partisan office, and, you know, it'll be somebody after the current occupant and somebody after that. This is quite a list of items that a person would find in statute facing them, and it makes me uncomfortable.
Representative Garrett.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe this is for Mr. Trout, but in response to these concerns, isn't that current law? There is nothing listed in statute currently, and therefore the Secretary of State is already given unfettered discretion to decide what inhabitant means. So we're certainly not creating any more discretion with the statute. If anything, we're trying to give the Secretary some guidance as to how that term should be interpreted. So we certainly won't have any risk of less consistency under this bill, and we'll probably be getting more consistency, if I'm correctly understanding both the constitutional issue and what the bill says.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Garrett, that's correct.
All right.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In your comments on the bill, you often use the word resident. And of course, the constitutional language is inhabitant. Do those mean different things, or is that what this bill's about?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart, that's a good portion of what this bill is about. The Constitution says that you have to be an inhabitant to run for the office. But then voter registration is based on residence, and there are different residency requirements to run for office because the Constitution prohibits limitations on that inhabitancy.
Okay.
So the statute defines, the statute, there are clear guidelines which these for inhabitancy were based on. So within the statute it says residency and consider these for residency. And so we're trying to give us more direction, or I believe Representative Holvey is trying to give us more direction and a framework in order to make these distinctions with respect to inhabitancy and residence, because they are not necessarily the same thing.
Okay. Good. Two lines of questioning that occur to me as I'm trying to think about this problem. The first one is, do we know what this word inhabitant meant in 1859 when the Constitution was adopted? I mean, is there any guidance at all in the historical record about what that word meant?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart, I'm not aware of that. I know that Legislative Council worked with us on this in the drafting. I don't know if they looked into any history, but I'm not aware of the history of the legal term in 1859.
I mean, my understanding, of, if I may, Mr. Chair,
please.
My understanding of the Constitution is that big chunks of it were borrowed or copied, essentially, from other state constitutions. I don't know whether this is one of those pieces or not, but it's possible that there may be some guidance from that other state in terms of what they thought the word meant at that time might be of some help. The other question, if I may, Mr. Chair, is the different thread. Is it possible that a person could be a resident of San Francisco, California, but an inhabitant of District 8 in Barhagen?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart, yes.
Ooh. Okay. Now my head starts to hurt.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, if I can follow up, I mean, we talked about this in the original hearing where we have this a lot with members of Congress who, you know, established their residency in the District of Columbia but still have an intention to return. Members of the military mm-hmm. who are serving overseas but have an intention to return. So that's the key criteria with respect to residency is if you have an intent to return, then you maintain residency.
We also do have legislative counsel in the room if there's any
benefit of bringing her up. There is a key difference, if I think, unless I've seriously misunderstood it, and I may very well have, there is no residency requirement to be a member of Congress, and no inhabitancy requirement. It's who gets the job based on the criteria established in the U.S. Constitution. Originally, of course, it meant that to be a senator, you had to be appointed by the state legislature. Now, of course, it means an election. But I don't believe there's any requirement that says you have to live there in any way of defining that word. And I think that's true for Congress as well in the U.S. Constitution.
Gina, why don't you go ahead and come see if you can go ahead and take a shot at that, and Gina can back you up.
Do you want to answer? Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnard, I believe there is a resident. You have to be a resident of the state to be elected to Congress at the time that you take the office. So you don't have to be a resident of the state in order to run, but once elected, you have to be able to have residency within the state with which you represent.
Respond to that? You got to identify yourself for the record.
Gina Zedlick from Legislative Council, and just as a general comment, I don't know what I missed on my walk down here, but I think Steve's talked about this before, that we've got kind of competing but very similar words and for different purposes. We have residency is what's used for voter registration and maybe federally, I'm not sure. And then we also have the Oregon Constitution, which is specific to senators and representatives of the state, which uses the word inhabitancy. And so I think the -1 amendments, what they do is they echo what's already, so one's statutory and one's constitutional, and so the -1 amendments echo what the Secretary of State already does to determine residency for voter registration purposes. So it's similar, and I think that's where maybe some of the lines are getting, where some of the confusion is.
Anything further, Representative Barnhart?
Thank you. No.
Anything further for either Gina or Steve? Okay. Thank you both. Appreciate you coming up. Representative Holby, what's your thinking on this? Do you want to go ahead and pull the mic toward you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it is somewhat of a complex issue, yet it on the surface appears very simple and very confusing, I guess, to some degree. I'd like a chance to work with a couple of folks on the committee to see if we can hammer out maybe a further detail or two to see if we can gain more comfort on the bill. If you could carry this bill over to next Wednesday, that would be my preference.
And I know that Coach Olson has expressed a willingness to work with you on that. And I think we clearly have a problem here, and I think none of us, and probably the Secretary of State's office, doesn't even want to have the endless tools of interpretation of just that broad constitutional language to be able to make the decision, so we can then all throw rocks and water balloons at them for whatever decisions they make. So I think I hope we can get to a place, both for our sake and for their sake, of clarifying this. So we'll carry this over to our agenda for next Wednesday, a week from today, and close the work session on House Bill 3576 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3628. Invite Representative Parrish forward.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3628 exempts from the minor imposition of alcoholic beverages prosecution a person who dials 911 to report the need for medical assistance of a minor due to alcohol consumption, remains on the scene until medical assistance arrives, and cooperates with law enforcement personnel. It specifies that this exemption does not apply to a person who is operating a motor vehicle.
Great. Representative Parrish and guests, welcome to the Rules Committee.
Thank you. It's actually, I've not been to the Rules Committee before. First time off session. Well, you know, folks, I'm
going to just identify yourself for the record.
Parrish, Julie Parrish, House District 37, Westland, Wallaton, and a few nibbles of some other little cities. I'm bringing today to you House Bill 3628. I can't actually take the credit for this. The young lady with me today is Ms. Shelby Verstee. She's a resident of Newport, Oregon. She's a constituent of Representative Cowan. Shelby happened to, I don't know, hear the rumor that I answer my own emails, and sent me an email and asked me a couple questions about a bill concept that passed in California, I believe, last year. And, you know, we're citizens legislature, and I guess my, you know, we all have a different perspective and vantage point to the world, and I certainly consider myself a business owner, but I'm also a mom, and I think that's the most proud thing I wear on my resume. And so having raised children backwards in our house, we started with teenagers that weren't ours and then moved to middle school children and then to infants. When we had a teenager in our house, the house rule was, we don't want you to drink, we don't want you to smoke, we don't want you to get into trouble, but if you do, pick up the phone and call us. And I think if you've ever had children, I think we've all had that conversation with a teenager at some point, or maybe your parents gave you that at some point. Pick up the phone, give us a holler, we'll come get you. This bill, 3628, actually, is, again, similar type concept. If you're in trouble, pick up the phone. We're going to have a conversation about it, but you're going to kind of get a little bit of a pass because we're going to try to get you to be acknowledge, A, I did something wrong, but B, do the right thing. So the California legislature passed a similar bill concept when a young lady named Shelby was underage drinking with a friend, and the young lady passed out. The parents were asleep. The friend didn't want to get in trouble, and the young lady died of alcohol poisoning for lack of a call to 911. So 3628 simply says that if you are underage drinking, which we don't condone, but we know it happens, so if you are and you are with somebody or you yourself are in trouble and you make the call to 911, that you're still going to, there's going to be some consequences, but we're gonna give you a little bit of a pass for trying to do the right thing. And I'm going to let Shelby go ahead and introduce herself and explain why she thinks this bill is important. And this is our process right here at work. When a young constituent can come and bring a bill forward, idea forward, we can hear it and maybe make something happen for kids.
Okay. Welcome to the Rules Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Shelby Versteeg. I am an eighth grader attending Newport Prep Academy. I support HB 3628, and I'm here today with my mother, Jennifer Versteeg, the program coordinator for the Lincoln Commission on Children and Families. In response to an overwhelming rise in binge drinking in my community, there has been a lot of work going on over the past few years to raise awareness and raise the enforcement of the underage drinking laws. Our Commission on Children and Families was successful in securing an enforcement of underage drinking grant and a drug-free communities grant. Those grants raised awareness in our community members and law enforcement. And along with this, my school and every school in the county adopted stricter policies concerning MIPs. While that did help in some cases, that made many youths turn a blind eye to alcohol poisoning, or they tried to attempt to handle situations themselves in which medical attention was necessary to avoid an MIP. As Representative Parr said, I had read an article about a 17-year-old girl named Shelby Allen who had died because her friends were too afraid to call 911, or they were just too out of it to think, oh, maybe we should call. I related to this girl not only by name, but we share several other similarities. Our honor students were both athletes, and we both loved to write. And I realized that could have been me in her place. It could have been me. It could have been one of my friends. It could have been a kid from my school. So after some research, because, you know, I was curious what happened to this girl, I discovered that a law was passed in California petitioned by the girl's family after her death. This law was similar to this, and it had the potential to prevent this from happening again and save another young adult's life. While the majority of kids in Lincoln County don't drink, it only takes once to make a mistake, and I think we should prevent that once from being that mistake. Because of my previous work with the Oregon Legislature for a school project, I was in contact with Representative Julie Parrish, and after I discovered the California bill, I sent her an email to see if we had anything similar in Oregon. Thanks to all of her work, I'm here today. I know underage drinking is wrong. There should be consequences. However, in the instance of life and death, I don't want the consequences to be in the way of life. That's all. Thank you for your time, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Very well spoken. Some of the best testimony we've had before this committee all session.
Yeah. This is a very boring committee, by the way.
Questions for our witnesses? Thank you very much. Appreciate being here.
I guess I'd just like to close and say, you know, when you've got kids are great. You know, I had a conversation with my son the other day, and you know, he asked me was about what I was doing in the building, and I gave him an example, and immediately he just had this sense of justice and right and wrong, and they see things through a lens. I think sometimes that we don't see things through, it gets really hard to get past that, and yet, you know, our youth have either a lack of a filter, or they have better filters than we do sometimes as adults. And they, you know, so to see a student who went through some time here at the legislature, got to see the process, and then had an idea and brought it forward. This was one of my priority bills. She emailed me. I dropped it right away. Went and then found her representative and said, hey, you got a gal from your district who's interested in this. Representative Cowan does know that Ms. Versteeg and her family are here in the building today and couldn't get down to the hearing. So, good bill should pass, right? So, thank you.
Thank you very much. Anyone else like to testify on House Bill 3628 who has not signed up? Okay, then we will close the hearing on House Bill 3628. And Mr. Stembridge, remind me on House Bill 3148, are we just awaiting a fiscal on that, or remind me where we are on that? Let me go ahead and just open a work session on House Bill 3148.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3148 is the bill that you heard on March 4th. It has to do with signatures required for including materials in the voter's pamphlet. We've had the Dash 5 amendment for a while, although that has not officially been brought to the committee until this work session. It sets the number of signatures required at 400 per state senator and 200 per state representative. It defines active elector, and it deletes a proposed restriction on signatures submitted by political parties or assemblies. We requested the fiscal a week ago, but I think we're finding that because of the number of bills that are being run in other committees, they're putting the Rules Committee towards the lower priority right now. I think maybe that'll change as the session goes on, but for right now, we don't have fiscal on this House Bill 3148-5.
I think even as the week goes on, I think that will change. Mr. Co-Chair.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I see. Jim, we do have fiscal on the Dash 4s, right?
We have a fiscal on the Dash 3. I don't think we saw the Dash 4. Let me just
Dash 4s reflect 200 signatures, I think, level for both the House District and Senate District. I was having a conversation with Representative Cannon about that, and he was inclined to go more that direction than with the Dash 5s. And it's probably some of the reason behind that is because if we send it over to the Senate anyways, they might end up send it backwards for concurrence with 200.
Because they think their life should be easier than ours. That's a question that answers itself. You don't need to answer.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think the committee has received the Dash 4s. We have the Dash 3s, and I believe when we got the Dash 5s, we asked them to hold off on the fiscal for the Dash 3s.
So at this point, we don't have a fiscal on either the Dash 3 or the Dash 5?
I believe that we do. I would have to go up and check my paperwork, but I don't see anything in this file.
So, Coach Olson, what were you
I guess thinking? We should probably wait, find out
okay.
what our fiscal is.
Yeah.
Do you want us to hold for a moment, Jim, to make sure? Or are you pretty confident we don't have the fiscal on either?
I'm pretty confident. We do not have access to the fiscal programming here in the room. We could, if you want to stand at ease for 5 minutes, I could run upstairs and check.
Yeah, let's stand at ease because the other bill on our agenda, let me go ahead just in case anyone's here on the other bill. I will. You go ahead and go. Is anyone here to testify on 2946? That is a bill that has some constitutional problems, so we're not going to be moving that. I just want to give anybody a chance who was here to testify on the opportunity to do so. So we will, we're still in a work session on House Bill 3148. We'll just stand at ease until Mr. Sandbridge gets back. Okay, we'll come back to order. Representative Stembridge, please report. Representative Stembridge. Mr. Stembridge, please report.
We could do worse.
Mr. Chairman, Jim Stembridge, the committee administrator. And I would report to you that we have no fiscals on the dash 3 or the dash 5, and I have not received the dash 4 to ask for a fiscal on. So if there's a dash 4 out there that somebody wants, I need to get it so I can ask for the fiscal.
Let me just add, is anyone here pursuing the dash 4s on this bill? I'm not aware that anyone is pursuing the dash 4s. I haven't even seen the dash 4s, so, okay. I just want to make sure that we're not waiting on that fiscal. Nobody's anticipating that. Okay, so we'll go ahead and carry House Bill 3148 over to the Monday agenda,
You could adopt, please.
Let's go away. Yeah. All right. So we'll close the work session on House Bill 3148, and I don't think we have any other business before us, so we are adjourned.
Yeah.
Right before your eyes.
Figure out what.
It was quiet.
Good death.
Yeah.